safer outposts on the eastern seaboard. This particular plane had taken damage the night before and had subsequently been stranded in Cleveland. Mechanics were supposed to be finishing up repairs now. Beckham hoped it would be ready when they landed. Any delay in getting to Team Ghost could cost them their lives. Lights on the horizon caught Beckham's attention. He leaned closer to the window. His vision blurred in his injured eye again, partially due to exhaustion. But he didn't need perfect vision to make out the inferno in the distance. The blaze stretched across miles of terrain. He put on a headset, got up from his seat, and made his way to the cockpit. "What's burning?" Both pilots had pushed up their night vision optics as they looked at the glare to their south. "That was Pittsburgh," said a pilot. "Hasn't stopped burning since the new kit." A lump formed in Beckham's throat. Hearing that Pittsburgh was hit by a nuclear strike had been disheartening enough. Seeing it in reality, after it had become hell on Earth, was worse. He stayed in the cockpit, watching as they flew closer. A crater in the middle of the city showed where buildings had been swept away in the tidal wave of fire. Flames consumed the land around the impact zone, chewing through old neighborhoods in another of America's most iconic cities. Having seen enough of the horrific sight, Beckham returned to his seat. Most of the Rangers were still sleeping, but Horn was awake now.
"Sup, boss?"
he asked, stretching his big arms.
"We're passing Pittsburgh."
Horn looked toward the cockpit. Big white flakes now plastered the plexiglass.
"That's snow?"
Horn asked.
"Bit early, isn't it?"
"Too big to be snow," Beckham said. He checked the window behind them. The flakes left a black powder.
"That's ash," came a voice across the troop hold.
It was Sergeant Gray, a hulking, dark-skinned man who reminded Beckham of a long-deceased ranger that had fought with Team Ghost during the First War, a man named Tank, because of his size and strength. Horn sat up straighter, fully alert. He drew in a deep breath and shook his head.
"Jesus.
People are monsters," said another ranger wearing glasses, named Nathan Brooks.
"Huh?"
Gray said. "The ash," said Brooks. "It's not just the buildings and trees. It's the remains of humans and variants, too." Horn ignored the rangers and nudged Beckham's arm.
"You get any shut-eye?"
"Not really."
"You'll need it for Cali."
"I know." Horn was right, but closing his eyes felt like a betrayal to the people who had died from the nuclear blast and the all-consuming flames. The military hadn't been able to evacuate everyone here in time when the bomb dropped.
"Seriously, boss, get some sleep,"
Horn entreated.
"You used to nap in the shittiest conditions."
"That was before I had a family and the entire world was teetering on extinction."
"Yeah, and that's why you need your sleep."
Beckham nodded.
"You win."
Sleep would help him save people. All it takes is all you got, he thought. The Marine Corps quote helped ease that burden slightly. He repeated those words in his head like a mantra until his mind cleared. Fatigue sucked him in, and he drifted off. A voice jerked him awake some time later.
"We got a hot LZ," shouted one of the pilots.
Adrenaline cut through Beckham's groggy mind. The Rangers were already slamming magazines into their rifles as the bird began its descent. Brooks, the corporal with the glasses, pumped shells into a shotgun. Beckham glanced out the window behind him. He couldn't see much, but the apocalyptic urban landscape unfolding before him must have been Cleveland, or at least what was left of it.
"Captain Beckham, I'm not sure putting down is a good idea," said the primary pilot.
Beckham stood and went back to the cockpit. Flames scraped toward the sky from piles of rubble and toppled buildings. Tracer rounds split the darkness. Scanning the ground, Beckham saw the freeway that had been cleared of vehicles. The C-130 sat there waiting.
"Our ride's still there," Beckham said. "Did they finish the repairs?"
"Yes, but I really don't want to drop you boys off in that shit show," the primary pilot said. "Some of the guards are already retreating with the mechanics."
He could have been pissed at them for running from the fight, but looking at the destruction surrounding them, it was hard to blame them. A handful of military vehicles on the makeshift runway fled the defensive perimeter set up around the LZ,
In the glow of industrial lights, Beckham spotted two small single-prop planes waiting to take off. Muzzle flashes sparkled across the road as shadowy figures advanced on the vehicles.
"We have to get on the C-130, Beckham said. "We'll clear a path so you can take us down."
"Captain," said the pilot.
"That's an order," Beckham said.
He returned to the troop hold and directed the other soldiers to put on their night vision goggles.
"Change of plans," Beckham said, shouting to be heard over the blast of the bird's rotors. "We're going to clear the LZ so the pilots can touch down."
The Rangers all nodded, and Horn stepped up to the crew chief who was preparing the M240 in the open door.
"Step aside, Buttercup," he said.
The crew chief backed away, and Beckham handed him a spare rifle to use instead. They opened the opposite door, and the Rangers moved into firing positions. Even in the past few minutes, monsters had streamed toward the airfield. On both sides, they slammed into the fences. One section had already come down. Creatures trampled over it, bolting toward the meager defenses. It was hard to see much, despite the optics, but Beckham spotted a few brave remaining soldiers, three armored vehicles, and two mobile trailers set up on the shoulder of the freeway. Half the convoy had already fled. Those vehicles had pulled some of the variants away from the C-130, but more monsters descended from the surrounding neighborhoods toward the broken fence. The chopper circled, giving Beckham a better view from another angle. He flipped up his NVGs. The generator-run floodlights on the ground illuminated a group of at least 10 soldiers fighting back the beasts approaching the tail of the C-130. A massive fireball suddenly blasted out of a building in the center of the outpost, distracting Beckham for a moment. Maybe the collaborators had hit the outpost from the inside, too. But he couldn't worry about that now. Their job was to clear this area, get on the plane, and retrieve Team Ghost. The chopper lowered, and Beckham gave the order to open fire. The bark of the M240 rang out as Horn went to work, raking the barrel like an artist. He painted a group of variants that were still climbing a fence, then turned his aim on a group that had already climbed over and were making a dash for the armored vehicles. Everyone in the Blackhawk who had a firing zone squeezed off calculated shots, picking off the variants. The dying creatures flopped over the highway, but more surged over the collapsed fence, rushing in from the ruined city surrounding the interstate.
"Keep them away from the plane," Beckham shouted.
The chopper lowered as the Rangers fired. Targeting the moving beasts from above wasn't easy, especially in the dark. But the men had experience, and with Horn's help, they cleared a wide enough swath to ensure a landing site. In the distance, Beckham noticed a swarming cloud against the moon and starlight. Distant fires bloomed on the top of buildings where this erratic cloud touched. Bats.
"Incoming!" Beckham shouted. "Bats headed our way!"
He retreated into the troop hold and grabbed Horn. A wave of explosive-laden VX-99 modified creatures slammed into the cockpit, splattering blood on the plexiglass. The pilots screamed in shock and pushed the chopper down toward the ground to avoid the cloud.
"Bail! Bail!" someone shouted.
Alarms blared throughout the bird. The voices of the pilots and panicked Rangers were silenced in a sudden eruption of flame. An explosion ripped through the plexiglass and metal. Adrenaline churned through Beckham, making the world seem to slow around him. He was still holding onto Horn, and together they jumped, plummeting toward the concrete. They fell nearly 6 feet before slamming against the pavement. The impact knocked the wind from Beckham's lungs. Pain shot through his joints. He rolled, stomping on his back. Fighting through the agony, Beckham pushed himself to his knees, keeping low. Horn lay prone, blood running down his nostrils. They watched as the burning chopper spun out of control, the cockpit completely enveloped by flames. Two Rangers jumped out before the bird slammed into the shoulder of the road, exploding in a fireball. Shrapnel seared through the air. Beckham turned from the catastrophe when he heard the fearsome growls of variants. Gunfire lanced into the charging monsters. A hand grabbed Beckham, pulling him up. The group of soldiers defending the C-130 had come to help, laying down covering fire. Muddled voices came from all directions, but Beckham couldn't make them out due to the ringing in his ears. In partial shock, he stumbled forward like a drunk, trying to follow the soldiers up the ramp and into the belly of the aircraft. Horn turned and helped Beckham inside. Brooks and one other ranger had already made it into the troop hold.
The outpost soldiers standing guard all piled in, shouting things that Beckham still couldn't hear. He felt the rumble of the engines as the plane pulled forward. Variants flooded the freeway. They raced after the plane on all fours. Their sucker lips tore back into snarls as they dashed after the plane, only to be blocked out with the rear ramp clicking shut. Panting, Horn collapsed on the deck.
"Jesus," he groaned.
Beckham could hear that. He rolled over to Horn.
"You okay, Big Horn?"
"Yeah, I think so.
You?"
"I'm alive," Beckham replied.
The outpost soldiers dropped into jump seats as the plane climbed from its improvised runway. Many of their faces were painted in horror. Horror that Beckham knew all too well. Escaping death wasn't new to him or these men, but losing brothers never got easier. He pulled himself into a seat, and Horn followed suit. The engines roared as the plane pulled away from the carnage. It was a long while before anyone spoke.
I lost my glasses, came a voice.
Beckham looked over to see Brooks.
"At least you made it out," said the other surviving ranger.
"What the fuck were those things?"
"Bats,"
Horn said.
"Rigged with explosives."
"They didn't look like bats," the man replied.
"They were huge."
"The monsters are mutated by VX-99, Beckham said. "They're larger and far more aggressive than normal bats." A few curses and angry voices followed. Beckham rested his head against the bulkhead. Something told him this was the easy part of what lay ahead. He closed his eyes, and this time, he fell right asleep. 10. The roar of the jets woke Timothy violently. He shot out of his sleeping bag. Ruckley was already at the window with a rifle, peering at the sky through the cracked glass of the abandoned farmhouse they had found. Moonlight glowed on her face as she looked out over a field overgrown with weeds. He searched the stars for the fighters, but didn't see them. The growl slowly faded until it was nothing but a low rumble.
"At least we're still in the fight," Timothy said. "Of course we are," Ruckley said.
She sounded confident. But after Outpost Portland, she had to know the variants and the collaborators were winning this war. Timothy sat back on his sleeping bag and took a sip of water from his bottle. They had been lucky to find a few camping supplies and other necessities stocked in this house. It had offered a refuge for the night, giving them the time to plan their next steps. Ruckley looked at her watch.
"I better relieve Neyland."
The young ranger was holding watch in the living room downstairs. Timothy had already served his rotation. He had spent most of the time staring out the windows at the field, picturing variants prowling through the tall weeds. He had imagined every rustling stalk of grass might be a monster. It had been unnerving, waiting for an attack. He was glad his shift was over.
"See you in a few hours," Ruckley whispered.
Timothy rested on the sleeping bag and a pillow he had found. His body was dog-tired. But the sound of fighter jets meant he wasn't falling back asleep anytime soon. He found himself thinking of how nice it would be to sleep on a real mattress again. Every bed in this house was covered in dark stains and mold from water leaking through the ceiling. He propped the pillow under his head and tried to think of happy memories, goading his mind to relax. Times when he and his father had spent their nights on Peaks Island fishing, or those hot summer days diving for lobsters with spear guns. He missed those moments of peace so much. More than anything, he just missed being with his father. Feeling his presence, knowing he was always there with words of reassurance or a long conversation when Timothy needed it. Darker images flooded his mind. That last night on the island, running through the woods. The gunshots, returning to the bunker to see his father cold. Lifeless. Pain turned to fear, forcing his eyelids open. He should have stayed in that bunker with his dad. He would have rather died then by his father's side, fighting instead of running with only decaying memories to hold on to. Anger and guilt tore at his insides, a monster more powerful than a variant. Sleep would be impossible now. He sat up and rubbed his eyes. Then heard a creak in the stairwell outside the bedroom.
Must be Neyland, he thought. Timothy watched the open door, waiting for the young Army Ranger to appear. But it wasn't Neyland who entered. Ruckley stepped into the room, a mask of worry on her face. Timothy instinctively grabbed his gun.
What is it?
Neyland's gone, she said. Something might be wrong. Grab your things.
Are we leaving?
Timothy asked, confused.
Maybe he's taken a shit.
None of the toilets in the house had been working, and they'd been forced to use a spot in the backyard. Maybe, but we can't risk it. Let's go. Timothy stuffed his meager belongings into his backpack and heaved it over his back. He left the sleeping bag and pillow. Then he followed her down the stairs. At the ground floor, she raised her rifle and strode out, clearing the room. Timothy followed, bringing his gun up. Two couches and a broken coffee table furnished the living room. There was no sign of Neyland. The weak moonlight streaming through the windows didn't reveal much. He didn't see any broken glass, blood, or trampled carpet to indicate a struggle or forced entry. If there had been, Timothy would have heard it. Ruckley led them through the living room into the kitchen. The curtains around an open sliding door blew in the breeze. The door led to the deck, and Timothy joined her out there in the cool night. The backyard was an acre of trees and grass that bordered an old farm field filled with weeds almost as tall as Timothy. Branches from the trees groaned and snapped in the breeze, masking any popping joints of prowling variants. Ruckley took the stairs down to the grass, using her night vision optics to check the area. Clouds passed over the moon, leaving Timothy nearly blind. He waited for it to pass, squinting to make out the shadowy shapes around him. He briefly considered calling out for Neyland, but if the ranger was taking a shit, he would return. If he wasn't, then yelling for the man was tantamount to calling all the variants lurking in the area to dinner. The clouds rolled away, and the moon again spread a carpet of white over the terrain. Timothy caught up to Ruckley and walked beside her. She suddenly stopped before a line of trees fencing off the property from the fields. The tall weeds swayed in the wind like waves, back and forth, almost hypnotic. Timothy aimed his rifle over the field, waiting for variants to come bounding out. His finger went to the trigger, and he steadied his breathing. Ears strained, he listened for the noises of the beasts. Instead of snapping jaws and nightmarish screeches, all he heard was the rustling branches and the whistle of the wind. "Where the hell did he go?" Ruckley whispered. She turned, then froze, staring at the house through her NVGs. Timothy didn't see anything.
"What?"
Ruckley took a step forward and aimed her rifle at the barns on the eastern side of the property about 20 yards from the main house. "Someone's watching us," she said. "Get ready to run." Timothy felt a ball forming in his throat. It wasn't just variants out there. As the implications crossed his mind, he found himself almost hoping it was collaborators. No, not if they have the drop, he thought. He would get his revenge, but not tonight. Tonight he had to survive. Something whizzed past his head as he took a step toward Ruckley. "Go," she said firmly. He turned and ran, seeing an arrow sticking out of a tree. It was still quivering from when it had stabbed into the bark. Another whistle of an arrow cut through the air. It lanced into Ruckley's arm, and she cried out in pain. Timothy stopped to fire a burst, but his shots were wild. Without any night vision, he couldn't see the shooters, wherever they were. He turned and ran for the fields, not slowing even when he pushed through the tall weeds. The rough blades scratched at his bare face, but he kept going. He couldn't see Ruckley, but he heard her breaking through the plants behind him. Voices yelled in the distance. One was familiar. It was Neyland.
"Help me," he shouted. "Please help me."
Had these people kidnapped the poor bastard? The end of the field came into focus. A dense forest covered a hill not too far away, but Timothy decided to crouch instead of making a run for cover.
"Ruckley," he said quietly.
No response. He waited a few moments, listening for her movements. Only the wind swayed the grass. The distant shouts had stopped too, and he didn't hear Neyland anymore. A chill of fear shivered through him. What if he was all alone now? He refused to believe it. Ruckley was still out there, and he couldn't just sit here and wait for her. Cautiously, he advanced with his rifle ready to fire at anyone on the other side of the weeds. A moment later, he reached the edge of the field and scanned for contacts through the shifting blades. He didn't see anyone out there. Darkness had swallowed much of the landscape, and these people seemed to be expert hunters. Suppressing his fear, he strode out of the foliage, staying low. The forest growing along the hilly terrain stretched before him. He ran low for cover.
"Timothy," came a voice. He froze. "It's me, Ruckley."
She was crouched behind a tree, waving her good arm. The arrow jutting out of her other arm was broken. Timothy joined her and hunched down. She winced as she aimed her rifle at the farmhouse and the two barns. A fire had started in a pit on the gravel drive, the glow flickering on the faded paint of the bigger barn. Timothy zoomed in on a pole sticking out of the fire pit, flames licking the sides. He spotted movement in the glare and moved his scope to the right. A figure dressed in camo was strung up on a cross. It had to be Neyland. His legs and arms were bound, and his mouth was now taped shut. A group of five people circled around, all holding crossbows.
"Collaborators," he whispered.
"I don't think so," Ruckley said. "I've never seen collaborators use crossbows. These freaks must be some sort of cult."
"We gotta do something. All they got are bows. We can take them."
He pictured how she had let that couple back in the church get slaughtered, how she was ready to give them up so they could continue their mission. Would she do the same to Neyland?
"There could be more," Ruckley said. "They're crazy, but they don't seem dumb. This is probably another trap. We go down there, thinking it's an easy shot, then they jump us from the weeds and fields."
"We're talking about Neyland, though," Timothy said. "We can't let them roast the guy."
"I know," she replied.
Timothy scanned for more targets, but saw none. The farmland was simply too dark.
"We have to be careful," Ruckley said, grimacing through her pain. "If we're doing this, you take the ones on the left, I'll take the right. Then if there are more in the fields, we'll flush them out. Conserve your ammo, and make each shot."
Before she finished her sentence, one of the figures ripped the tape off Neyland's mouth, then plucked a flaming stick from the fire pit and tossed it into the wood under Neyland's boots. The flames leapt up Neyland's body.
"Help me!"
Neyland wailed.
"Oh God, Ruckley, help me!"
Flames devoured his clothing and flesh. An agonizing wail filled the night. Neyland shrieked the entire time, his voice erupting in an animalistic cry of agony.
"Go!"
Ruckley snapped.
"What?"
"Go! I'll catch up!"
Timothy hesitated, then started walking away. A single gunshot rang out and then faded. He didn't need to turn to know the target had been Neyland, to put him out of his misery. Ruckley caught up a few seconds later. She breathed heavy, like she was trying to hold back tears from putting her friend and brother out of his misery. Timothy didn't even try to hold back his own tears. He had hardly known Neyland, but the man had deserved better. And so had his dad. Tears ran from his eyes. Timothy wanted to think there would be justice for Neyland and his father. But he knew in this new world filled with monsters and war, nothing was fair. Justice was nearly as extinct as good people. Dohai crouched at the edge of a hiking trail covered in long weeds, sweeping the path ahead with his night vision goggles. Behind him, he heard the crunch of Team Ghost and the Wolfhound's boots over twigs and dry grass. After escaping the enemy vessel, their advance to the evac site 10 miles from the C-130 was painfully slow, in part due to the Wolfhounds. The damaged freighter had sunk, but one of the birds had escaped. Dohai knew it was searching for them. That's why he had selected a straightaway section of I-280 outside Redwood City for their evac. They were only a few miles away now, just north of what had once been El Corte de Madera Creek Reserve, surrounded by massive trees. "Almost there," Dohai thought. "Keep pushing." They had given Jackson, Hopkins, and Lawrence their first round of antibiotics, but the medicine didn't work instantaneously, and they needed real medical professionals. Lawrence managed a steady gait, cradling his wounded arm. Dohai admired his fortitude. Martin was the only wolfhound who had survived both the cannibals and chimera attack unscathed. Now he helped Hopkins, who was missing one foot below the ankle. Despite Hopkins's protests, Rico carried the man, occasionally letting him lean on her shoulder as he walked with his remaining leg. Jackson remained unconscious, the stumps at both ankles still smelling slightly with necrosis. He was now on Ace's back, who walked with sweat trickling down his head. The occasional distant screeches of variants haunted them with every step. Somewhere amid the hilly, forested landscape, the beasts lurked. It wasn't just the monsters Dohai was worried about. There was no guarantee more chimeras from the freighter were enthralling the woods. And for that matter, the settlement of cannibals they had discovered in the National Accelerator Laboratory might not have been the only one. Another howl pierced the night. This one was closer. Dohai signaled for everyone to get down. Fitz came over to him and took a knee, while Rico and Mendez held security.
"How many do you think are out there?" he whispered.
"Sounds like a pack," Dohai replied. "Judging by the frequency of their calls, they're hunting us."
He studied the trees and the undergrowth of the forest. He didn't see any trampled vegetation, no claw marks, nothing to indicate any variants had been here recently, which meant to him these beasts hadn't randomly showed up to this park. They had Team Ghosts sent. He took a deep breath, peering through his NVGs at the green and black landscape. The team was relying on him to guide them safely through this unknown land to the rendezvous point. He couldn't mess up like he had at the National Accelerator Lab. Dohai gave the advance signal into the dark woods, cautiously approaching every gurgling stream and patch of bushes under the redwoods. Jackson's groaning got worse, and his breathing was ragged.
"He ain't going to make it much further," Ace whispered, his voice strained. "We need to put him down and change these bandages."
Ace was right. Dohai could smell Jackson's festering wounds. If he could smell it, that meant the variants could too. Dohai checked his watch. They still had a couple hours before evac. More than enough time to change Jackson's bandages, but they couldn't do it here. He surveyed the road ahead. Abandoned cars littered the cracked asphalt. A couple were nothing but charred husks. But it gave him an idea. This place had once been a campground, too.
"Look," Dohai said, pointing up the road. "This place is an RV park. We might find some shelter there."
Fitz gave a nod. The group marched along the road. Another variant shrieked, and a second beast answered the call. Dohai thought they sounded closer, but maybe it was just the acoustics of the open road now. The faster they took care of Jackson, the sooner they could get out of here. And if all went well, changing Jackson's bandages would cover the scent better. But they had to be fast. He increased his pace, seeing a sign with paint peeling away in big flakes. A short driveway led to an open space filled with wild grass. Nearly a dozen hookup spots for power, water, and sewer lines sprouted from the field. Of course, none would work, but Dohai had hoped to see a few RVs and trailers here, abandoned during the first war. All that was left was a single camper trailer with broken windows. The door was crumpled on the ground. Silver scars marred the paint, showing where variants had clawed their way inside. Fitz gestured for Dohai and Mendez to clear it while the others waited at the entrance to the RV park. The two operators flitted through the grass, then paused in front of the open door. Dohai listened for breathing or the snap of variant joints. With a nod, he entered. Mendez fell in behind him. Broken glass covered a built-in table and bench. Mold had crept over the kitchenette, and ragged curtains flapped at the back of the trailer where the bed was. Atop the bed was a skeleton, leathery flesh hanging off in ribbons, bite marks covering the bone.
"I'll take care of Jackson," Dohai said.
"I can help," Hopkins said. "Yeah, put us to work," Lawrence added, gesturing with his good arm. "We're happy to do something." "Right now, just focus on getting those bandages changed," Dohai said.
The smell of those things are going to attract every damn variant around. Ace, Rico, you're on security, Fitz said. Mendez, get Hopkins and Lawrence comfortable on that bench. Fitz dug into his pack and tossed them a first aid kit. Replace their bandages. Martin, take Jackson to that bed with me and Dohai. We need to clean him up fast before the variants are drawn to the scent. Ace carried Jackson to the back and waited to unload him onto the bed. Hurry, he grumbled. Dohai removed the skeleton and took the bony remains outside, but he didn't have time to worry about honoring the dead with a burial when it was the living that he needed to take care of. He went back inside, and Fitz took out more of the medical supplies they scavenged from the freighter to help Jackson. Dohai examined the soiled bandages. Martin looked over his shoulder, muttering a prayer that was cut short by a variant towel in the distance. Dohai tried to ignore the sounds, but having Martin hovering over him and muttering in his ear wasn't helping matters.
Be careful, Martin said.
I know what I'm doing, Dohai said. Jackson was unconscious, but his face contorted in pain when Dohai began unwrapping the bandages. They pulled away with a slurp from the bloodied stumps, tearing some of the diseased tissue. Dohai unraveled the last bandage. The odor of death filled the trailer. Pus and blood leaked out of cracked, blackened flesh. Martin retched and bolted outside to vomit. Fighting his own instinct to recoil, Dohai examined the wound. The cannibals had screwed up when they had tried to cauterize the flesh. Between the survival techniques his grandfather had taught him and the first aid skills he'd honed as an operator, Dohai knew this wasn't going to be an easy fix.
I need to debride this wound, clean it, then reapply the bandage, he said quietly. This necrotic tissue is going to get worse if we leave it, and the smell is going to keep those variants on us until we take care of it.
Do what you have to, Fitz said. Martin walked back inside, wiping off his mouth.
You good? Dohai said.
A nod from Martin.
Good, because I need your help. Put a cloth between Jackson's teeth. This is going to be painful, and he needs something to bite down on.
And try to keep him quiet, Fitz said. Martin tore a piece of old sheet from the bed and stuffed it between Jackson's teeth.
Here we go, Dohai said.
He took out his utility knife and scraped at the dead tissue, periodically washing it with fresh water. The dead flaking skin peeled away to reveal raw, red, infected tissue. Jackson groaned louder.
Oh shit, what's going on? Martin asked.
Blood started to spray from the wound, soaking into the bed like a dark shadow.
Shit, Dohai said. I think he had a nicked artery or something. The cauterized tissue was helping block it, but...
Fitz dug through the first aid kit for clotting gel, a hemostat, and sutures, handing the supplies over. Dohai cleaned away as much of the blood and dead tissue blocking their access to the artery, then tried dousing the wound with the clotting gel. The bleeding didn't stop, and the artery had retracted deeper into Jackson's leg.
This is going to hurt bad, Dohai said, pausing.
A lot. Martin, hold him down. Fitz, I need your help. Martin's dark skin seemed a shade lighter, a quiet terror evident in his face. Fitz came over with Martin to hold Jackson down. There was no way around this. Blood pumped from the wound. Jackson would be dead in minutes, and the smell of this blood would be worse than Jackson's wounds at attracting the monsters. Dohai quickly probed through the infected tissue, pushing past the fat and skin. Jackson snapped awake, eyes bulging from their sockets. He was fully conscious now. He screamed into the cloth, and Martin held the guy's head, trying to reassure him. But even with the cloth between his teeth, Jackson's scream was loud.
Hurry, Dohai, Fitz said. I'm working as fast as I can.
Dohai's heart thundered in his ears. He tried to ignore Jackson's screams and Martin's reassurances, the din filling the trailer. They might as well hang a flashing sign outside that advertised variant food here.
I got it, he said, catching the artery with two fingers and snapping the hemostat on it. Sutures, now!
He tied off the vessel, blood pouring over his hand. Jackson still screamed in pain, writhing. Fitz and Martin struggled to hold him in place. And then it was finished. Dohai poured more clean water over the wound. No more blood gushed out.
Jackson sobbed, muscular chest heaving in gasps before passing out again. The bed and floor were soaked with blood. The guy had lost so much. Dohai started wrapping Jackson's legs with fresh bandages. A chorus of variant shrieks came from outside. This time there was no mistaking their proximity. They knew Team Ghost and the Wolfhounds were here. Rico came into the bedroom and said in a low voice, "We got multiple contacts." "We're almost finished," Fitz said. Jackson's unconscious moaning faded into a rattling sigh as Dohai finished the last bandage. The man was quiet now. Too quiet. Dohai checked his wrist. His stomach plummeted through the floor. "He doesn't have a pulse." "What?" "No. Come on, Jackson," Martin said. He bent down to pump on the soldier's chest with his skinny arms. Another howl screamed outside. This one sounded closer. Two more inhuman voices answered it. "Movement at our 6 and 10. And Ace said, "Shit, they're coming from all directions." The shrieks grew louder even though Jackson had gone silent. The blood-soaked room had brought all the ravenous monsters to their position. Dohai looked at the lifeless man. All this effort, all this risk, for nothing. Jackson was dead, and now they were trapped in a trailer, surrounded by beasts being drawn to this corpse like hyenas around a wounded gazelle. 11. The wails of the injured and dying punctured the crackle of the flames dancing over City Hall Park. A tree buckled as flames devoured it. Ash and embers swirled in a harsh wind coursing down Broadway, carrying the stink of charred flesh and the rotten odor of dead variants. Fisher stood in the vibro-sized truck near the courthouse with his engineer, Brian Meyer. The engineer touched the blood-soaked bandage on his cheek. He needed stitches, but for now the bandage would have to suffice. Frankly, he was lucky to be alive. So was Fisher. Tran and Chase had saved them from a pair of variants that had managed to break through the other defenses and get to the truck. After the first wave of beasts, they had lost too many men in Bogardus Garden to hold the position. They had been forced to move and consolidate their defenses around City Hall. "How's it looking?" Fisher asked Meyer. The engineer studied the geophone readings across his monitor. "So far, no activity to indicate new tunnels. Let's pray it stays that way. Shout if you see anything, even if it's so much as an earthworm coffin down there." Fisher got down from the truck and joined Massey. Chase and Tran shouted him, each looking nervously around the carnage. "The vibro-sized truck is ready for the next wave," Fisher said. Massey nodded and let out a long exhale. "We lost nearly a third of our men in that last attack. Even if the variants are weaker, it's going to be hell. We'll keep a close eye on those tunnels to ensure they don't catch us with our pants down. The M1 is ready to go again as soon as you spot something. It might be our saving grace. What about the other M1 I saw back at the outpost? It stays there, to protect the civilians as a last resort." Fisher looked up at the tall buildings around them for the helicopters. "Any Apaches?" "Running low on fuel," Massey said. "Trying to keep them as a last resort as well." Fisher hated seeing them hold back on their most powerful weapons, but he decided it was a good plan. Last resort, he thought. "Radio if you need me," Massey said. "I'm going to check the defensive barricades again." Fisher took a long swig of water, then looked between Tran and Chase. "You boys doing all right?" "Remember how you promised a drink on the beach when this is all over?" Tran asked.
"Of course."
"I'm thinking a luxury cruise now."
"You both deserve it," Fisher said.
"I know you didn't sign up for this when you joined Fisher Fields, but I have to commend you for stepping up when the country called for us."
"We go where you go, sir," Tran added. Meyer called from the truck.
"Mr. Fisher, I've got activity."
Adrenaline flooded Fisher. He ran as fast as his old bones would take him back to the engineer. Spikes of activity bloomed across the monitor. Seismic waves bounced around the neighborhood surrounding City Hall Park. Fisher grabbed his radio.
"Commander Massey, they're on their way. I've got confirmed activity about 6 blocks north. Looks like they'll be inbound at Center and Chambers."
"Copy. We're moving the M1 now," she replied.
The tank's diesel engines growled to life, and the treads crunched over the disheveled street. Men followed behind it as they found new positions, aiming toward the intersection at the corner of City Hall Park.
4 blocks now, Meyer reported. Fisher gripped the barrel of his shotgun. 3 blocks now.
10 minutes passed before the ground started to crater around a manhole on Center. Fisher watched through the windshield of the truck. Tran and Chase got beside the vehicle, aiming at the shifting and cracking pavement. For a moment, only the crackle of fires in the park and abandoned buildings nearby could be heard. Then the asphalt fell away in a loud crash. A variant climbed from the freshly formed pit, rearing back on its legs, muscles pulsing under sickly gray flesh. It opened its mouth, saliva spraying from its teeth as it screamed. A pack of monsters erupted from the tunnel behind it, a mix of armored juveniles and the sinewy adults.
"Open fire!" Massey yelled.
The concentrated boom of rifle and machine gun fire exploded across the block. Tracer rounds cut from the machine gun nests in the neighboring buildings. Even as the first wave of monsters perished under the onslaught, others squirmed between the dead bodies of their brethren climbing onto the street. Grenades sailed toward them. Blasts sent chunks of singed meat smacking against asphalt and clouds of smoke blooming from new fires. The M1 fired with a deafening boom. A geyser of asphalt and dirt burst from the hole with a resonating boom. The beasts' bodies were thrown into the air, then came down in a gruesome rain of mangled body parts. A wave of dust billowed from the impact site.
"They're still coming," Chase said.
Fisher moved past Meyer and aimed out the open window of the truck. He sighted up one variant galloping out of the rolling cloud of dust and debris. With the butt of his shotgun tight against his shoulder, he squeezed his trigger. The blast tore through the monster's chest, sending it tumbling over itself.
"Shit, sir. Shit," Meyer said. "We've got more activity under the park."
Fisher turned back to the screen.
"Under us?" "Yes. The beasts are digging a new tunnel."
Screams echoed outside as a variant lunged at a soldier, tearing into him with claws and teeth. Another man went down as juveniles piled on top of him, ripping him apart like a pack of dogs. Fisher held up his radio.
"Commander, the variants are attacking from Elk and Chambers."
"That's near the M1, she replied. The tank fired another round that decimated the entrance of the tunnel. A group of beasts disappeared in a violent inferno. Fisher expected that to be the end of them. But more monsters squeezed out from the cracked slabs of asphalt and rubble, bloody and burned. Sniper rifles cracked from above, like angels of war, protecting the men on the ground from the creatures getting too close.
"They have stopped right below us," Meyer said.
"Get out of here," Fisher said. "Retreat to the main defenses and stay there."
"But, sir, do it," Fisher said. "We can't hold this position."
Another pair of variants made a break from the broken entrance of the tunnel. They rushed at the Viber-sized truck. Fisher hopped beside Tran and Chase while Meyer ran. They brought down the first monster, but the second ran low, ducking behind the bodies of its comrades. It coiled and jumped, soaring toward Fisher. He clenched up, watching in what seemed like slow motion as the beast descended on him, claws extended. Suddenly, the beast's mouth disappeared in a blast of pink tissue and bone spreading. Tran kept his rifle aimed at the creature when it crashed to the ground, finishing it with a shot to the back of the head. Blood pooled away from the beast to Fisher's boots. He tried to control his breathing.
"Fisher, where are those monsters on Elk?" Massey called over the radio. "I can't spare my men if they aren't actually coming."
"They're beneath the street," Fisher replied.
Suddenly, part of Chambers Street cracked. The monsters had stopped climbing out of the hole on Center. A loud roar carried up out of the fissures across Chambers. But this was not the cry of a monster. It sounded like rushing water. The heavy weight of horror plunged through his insides at the implications.
"Massey, pull your men off the streets," Fisher yelled over the radio. "Get them away from the buildings and move that tank back to the park, now!"
Dirty brown water exploded out of the cracks in Chambers, pouring through the streets. Soldiers backed away from it like it was poison. It wasn't the water itself Fisher was afraid of. It was what the rushing water meant. The tank growled as it rotated and then powered down Chambers toward the park. The asphalt buckled under its tracks, crumbling away in an instant.
A massive hole ripped down the road, swallowing men and vehicles. The tank crashed through the collapsing earth, followed by the second Viber-sized truck. It took Fisher a second to realize what had happened. New York City's famous water system was fed by gravity, meaning the huge tunnels that had once transported tap water to buildings throughout the city were still filled with stagnant water.
"The variants burst a water main!" Fisher shouted. "We all have to fall back!"
Variant shrieks echoed up from the splashing, untreated water filling the tunnel they had dug. Human screams followed, giving Fisher no illusion of what was happening in this freshly formed canyon. He looked back into his Viber-sized truck and saw more seismic activity on the screen. Another sinkhole formed under a building where machine gunners and snipers were roosted. One of the Apaches was stationed atop it. The building started to quiver, cracks tracing up its sides. The Apache blades started spinning, but it was too late. The building collapsed inward, and a huge cloud of dust rolled over the park. Panicked voices exploded over the radio.
"We're pulling back from the pump house park,"
someone yelled over the radio. "So it's not just here," Fisher thought. His mind thundered with questions on how this could be happening. The variants had pulled a tactical maneuver, distracting the defensive forces and striking in a way no one could have predicted. A second building collapsed into the growing sinkhole. Water flooded the streets, and a debris cloud rolled over the defensive forces. Soon, the gray and brown haze was too much. Fisher could only see shadows moving in the dust. Screams and the sound of gunfire split the air. Tran and Chase pressed up against the back of the truck, fighting off monsters emerging out of the haze. The truck's geophone monitor burst with more activity as sinkholes sucked in men and spat out more variants. There was no way he could hold the truck with just Tran and Chase. This station was already lost. There was nothing they could do but retreat. Cracks formed in the ground around them, the earth trembling.
"Massey," Fisher yelled into his radio, "we're abandoning the Viber-sized truck and headed your way."
"Alpha," Tran yelled. His rifle burst to life as a creature barreled through the fog toward them. The monster let out an ear-splitting shriek, muscles rippling under its fur. Bullets plunged into its flesh, blood spraying from the wounds, but the monster kept coming with a tide of variants following in its wake.
"Move!" Fisher yelled.
Tran and Chase led the way, stopping every few strides to lay down covering fire. The Alpha slammed into the Viber-sized truck behind them, pushing it over. Variants scaled the toppled vehicle, jumping over it and chasing after Fisher and his men. Fisher slowed when he saw a monster feasting on a body ahead. He fired a buckshot into the ugly creature, knocking it off the victim. A second passed before he realized the shredded body was Meyer. Most of the engineer's face had been mauled off, and Fisher only recognized him by the Fisher Fields logo emblazoned on his coveralls.
"God damn it!" Fisher shouted.
Gunfire cracked behind him as Tran and Chase backpedaled while firing at the Alpha still hunting them.
"Run!"
Chase yelled. Fisher pumped another shell into his shotgun and brought the weapon up to blast a variant in their path. Tran and Chase took measured shots at the other creatures, cutting down the Alpha's forces. They hit the bigger beast with periodic bursts, and it finally started to slow.
"Reloading,"
Fisher said as he plucked new cartridges from his vest. Tran's rifle bolt clicked back.
"Me too."
The Alpha seemed to sense their momentary weakness and barreled forward, knocking aside smaller variants. Chase fired, but the beast was too fast. It grabbed Tran, then yanked him backward, disappearing back into the dust cloud.
"Tran!"
Fisher shouted. He pumped his shotgun and ran after the beast.
"Wait!"
Chase yelled. Fisher strode out into the dust cloud with Chase by his side.
"Tran!"
they both yelled. More explosions burst behind them, screams piercing the crack of increasingly sporadic gunfire. Fisher saw almost nothing through the rising dust cloud as other buildings collapsed. He continued yelling for Tran, but the man was gone, taken underground where he would suffer a worse fate than being torn apart up here.
"Sir, we have to go," Chase said.
The roar of a diesel engine sounded in the distance, and Fisher followed Chase toward the noise. They broke through the dust to find a black 4x4 pickup with a group of soldiers in the bed and another climbing up.
"Get in!"
Massey yelled from the driver's window. Fisher looked back toward the dust cloud one last time, praying Tran wouldn't suffer long. A hand grabbed Fisher by the arm. Chase helped him up into the bed of the truck as they abandoned their friend to the monsters. In the troop hold of the C-130, Beckham stared out one of the small windows. The first molten rays of the sun climbed above California. The pilots had said they were only about 10 minutes out from Team Ghost's evac site. The morning light washed through the aircraft as the crew and a handful of soldiers in the jump seats made their final preparations for landing. None knew what to expect. This was enemy territory. Horn clicked a drum into his M249 saw. Then he reached inside his vest and pulled out a black bandana emblazoned with a skull, an old memento of his time on Team Ghost. He tied it around his neck. Nathan Brooks, the Army Ranger who had lost his glasses, had offered to help, but like the other injured Ranger who had survived the crash in Cleveland, he couldn't do much. The kid was practically blind without his glasses, and the other Ranger had broken an ankle after jumping out of the Black Hawk.
"Once we land, everyone who can will hold security," he said. "This area is going to be hot, and we know there are hostiles, both human and variant. But we want to go in and out quick and quiet. Do not shoot unless you're given the order. Got it?"
Nods all around. The plane dipped lower, and Beckham started toward the rear door when a message hissed in his earpiece.
"Captain Beckham, we just got a message about Ghost," said the primary pilot. "We need you up here."
Beckham hurried to the cockpit. One of the pilots turned to him. "Command just pinged us. Ghost called them on the sat phone a while ago. They're surrounded by variants about a mile from the rendezvous coordinates." Beckham clenched his jaw.
"How do you want us to proceed?" asked the pilot.
With only moments to decide, Beckham scanned the sky for aircraft and the freeway below for contacts. He didn't see any hostiles yet.
"Take us down. Horn and I will go in on foot to clear their escape."
Beckham made his way back to Horn.
"Trouble?"
Horn asked.
"Plenty." "You know I'm always ready for trouble, but what does plenty mean?"
"Ghost is pinned down by variants. We'll need to extract them."
Horn pulled his skull mask up.
"And that's just what we'll do."
"Prepare for landing," said the primary pilot.
A few moments later, the plane touched down on the interstate, wind rushing over the spoilers as the engines applied reverse thrust and they decelerated hard into a stop. A crew chief pushed a button on the bulkhead, opening the rear ramp.
"Back into the fray,"
Horn grumbled. He strode down the ramp with his saw shouldered. Beckham raised his M4 and loaded a grenade into the barrel-mounted M203 launcher. He followed Big Horn into the morning sunshine.
"Good luck," came a voice.
Beckham glanced over his shoulder. Brooks raised a hand from the troop hold. All but two of the 13 soldiers and the crew streamed down the ramp past Brooks to hold security. Beckham jogged toward the coordinates where Ghost was supposed to be waiting. Maybe after their sat phone batteries had drained, they had actually made it there on their own, escaping the monsters. But Ghost and the injured wolfhounds were nowhere between the trees and grass where they were supposed to be. They might not have ever escaped the position where the variants had first surrounded them. The team's last known location was only a mile away. Beckham started running, Horn following. They could make it in under 8 minutes if they ran hard with their gear. Maybe less, but they weren't the same men they were back when they had been on Ghost. They got through an open field in a few minutes, but slowed on approach to the tree-covered hills. The terrain provided cover, which also meant shelter for a hostile ambush. Horn held up a fist. The chatter of small arms fire echoed over the hills.
"Sounds like one, maybe two guns at most," he said.
Beckham didn't like what that might mean and started running again. He didn't stop until he got to the crest of a hill. Navigating through the trees, he took a knee on an overlook of an RV park. Those were the coordinates where Ghost had reported they were being surrounded. Corpses lay scattered across the grass. The ground was so soaked with blood that the dirt had turned to mud in some spots. But the bodies weren't human. They were naked beasts, flesh riddled with bullet holes, spread around a camper trailer. Beckham zoomed in on the open door. The echoing pop of a gunshot pulled his gaze away from the scope. Horn pointed to the edge of the forest. Beckham led the way cautiously down the hill and across the corpse-strewn park.
One variant was still alive, partially buried in a crater of dirt from a grenade. The upper torso was still connected to the bottom by thick strings of gristle, somehow keeping it alive. It reached up and took weak passes at them with a claw. Beckham didn't waste a bullet or slow to pull his knife. The beast wasn't going anywhere and wasn't long for this world anyway. Shrieks sounded from the forest as they approached, and another gunshot answered. Then three more pops. Beckham and Horn bolted toward the sounds. A trail of corpses took them through the forest and along a road. Streaks of blood painted the asphalt. Empty bullet casings and shotgun shells lay scattered across the cracked street that traced up another hill. Horn caught up to Beckham, breathing heavily, and they approached the top side by side. They heard snarling and cracking, then a sickening crunch, followed by a shout.
"You want more, puta?"
The familiar voice had to be Mendez. Another voice, this one female, came next.
"Keep them back," yelled Rico.
Beckham and Horn neared the top of the hill. Sweat drenched their fatigues. About 200 feet away, a group of 10 variants prowled around Team Ghost, circling and waiting to pounce. Ace had a metal garbage lid that must have been from the RV park with claw marks across it in one hand and the butt of his shotgun in the other. Dohai tossed his hatchet at the closest variant, scoring a hit to the neck. Then he jabbed another creature with his knife. Rico and Fitz used their blades to parry and strike a beast lunging at them. Mendez slammed the butt of his rifle against a variant's face. Cartilage and bone cracked at the impact, blood sloshing out of its slitted nostrils. Team Ghost formed a ring around two injured soldiers wrapped in bandages. They must have been the surviving wolfhounds. A third wolfhound stood beside Ghost, fighting alongside them. Beckham raised his rifle, centering it on the first target.
"Ghost!"
Fitz glanced his way, then signaled for the team to close in around the injured as Beckham and Horn fired on the surrounding creatures. Blood gushed from monsters' new wounds, and wails of pain filled the morning. Three beasts made it out of the gunfire and started up the hill toward Beckham.
"I got this,"
he yelled as he palmed in a new magazine. Beckham cut the three creatures down with calculated bursts. Their bodies rolled back down the hill. Before anyone could celebrate the narrow victory, shrieks of more creatures rose in the distance. Covered in dirt and blood, Team Ghost and the wolfhounds looked like they had been through hell and back. The group of battle-fatigued soldiers marched up the hill with Rico at the lead. She reached out like she was going to give Horn a hug, but then fingered at his vest.
"We need magazines," she said, "for the way back."
Horn and Beckham distributed ammo.
"Damn good to see you, Captain,"
Fitz said as he graciously accepted a magazine.
"Wasn't sure we were going to make it out of here."
"We're not out yet, brother," Beckham said.
"What the fuck took you guys so long?"
said one of the wolfhound soldiers, a guy with a bloody name tape that read Martin.
"Give it a fucking rest," Mendez said. "They're here, aren't they?"
said another wolfhound. The guy's name tape said Lawrence. He helped another injured wolfhound who only had one foot.
"We need to move," Beckham said. "Keep close and tight."
He took point through the forest, scanning for any camouflaged variants lying in wait. The pace back to the C-130 was agonizingly slow because of the wounded wolfhounds that needed help walking. Dohai came up next to Beckham and they exchanged a nod. Shrieks of hunting variants followed the group. Beckham checked their six. Horn signaled to him he'd spotted three hostiles, variant scouts shadowing their retreat. The beasts were like wolves, waiting for the rest of their pack before they would move in for the kill. Beckham spotted Salvation ahead. The big body of the C-130 on the freeway was surrounded by a dozen soldiers that had spread out to provide cover. The sight gave the exhausted team the energy they needed to make the final stretch. As the variants closed in, Beckham led them straight up onto the freeway toward the C-130's open troop hold. Soldiers holding security jogged over to help take the wounded.
"Hell yeah," Mendez said.
He turned to look at the road behind them. Taking a hand off his rifle, he crossed his chest and kissed his fingers, head angled toward the sky.
"Thank you, thank you, thank you, Lord Jesus."
Then he paused, tilting his head.
"Aw, shit. Not now."
Beckham followed his gaze. A transmission crackled in his earpiece just as he saw the black aircraft against the blue.
We got incoming, Captain. Get your people inside now, said one of the pilots.
Beckham swallowed hard when he saw that contact was a Black Hawk.
Go, go, go!
Horn shouted, waving for everyone to run. There were sitting ducks on the interstate, and they had very few weapons capable of taking down that helicopter, barring an extremely lucky shot. As the team raced for the open hold, Beckham raised his rifle with its barrel-mounted M203 grenade launcher, and Horn aimed his saw, covering the others. The engines on the C-130 thrummed to life, drowning out the panicked voices of the retreating soldiers. Ace carried the Wolfhound with only 1 foot, and Rico helped the one with bandages across his arms into the plane. Mendez and Fitz stayed outside with Beckham as the chopper closed in.
Fire! Beckham shouted.
Rounds lanced into the bird. A door gunner on the Black Hawk opened fire with a mounted machine gun. Rounds tore into the belly of the C-130 and raked over the asphalt, sweeping toward Team Ghost. Beckham launched a grenade, hoping for a lucky shot, but the grenade sailed wide, landing amid the trees and kicking up a fiery cloud of dirt. Another soldier from the Black Hawk knelt at the open side door. He leveled an M-72 Law at them. All it took was one good hit, and their plane would be grounded, just like the C-130 that had initially taken Ghost here.
Take him down, Beckham shouted.
Bullets slammed into the side of the chopper. Horn unleashed his saw at the man with the rocket launcher, and Beckham launched another grenade. This one slammed into the troop hold as the Law rocket streaked away. It missed the plane and exploded somewhere behind Beckham. The resulting wave of heat threw him off balance. The chopper came screaming down toward them. Beckham ran out of its path as it slammed down sideways on the right side of the road, skidding across the grass. Fire spewed from its engine as its blades split and flew off its rotor. He stopped running, chest heaving as he scanned the road to make sure everyone was okay. Fitz, Dohai, and Horn were aiming their rifles at the downed bird in case anyone had survived. Ace was screaming from the troop hold, and Rico came running out. She stopped near a smoking crater, hand covering her mouth. When Beckham saw the twisted remains of a rifle, blood-soaked asphalt, and chunks of a torn boot, he realized why he hadn't seen Mendez yet. There wasn't anything left of him to see. 12. Kate sat at the edge of the cot after a night